meeting to order. This is the House State Affairs Committee. The time is 8 o'clock a.m. on Thursday, March the 11th, 1993. Would the Committee Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Albizzi.
Present.
Representative Harley Olberg.
Here.
Representative Pete Cott.
Here.
Representative Fran Ulmer.
Here.
Representative Betty Davis.
Here.
Representative Gary Davis.
Here.
Representative Jerry Sanders.
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum. All members are present. The first item on our agenda this morning is House Bill 81. We were handed a proposed committee substitute for House Bill 81. We have not adopted it. However, everybody should have had time to review the research report and the committee substitute. At this time, what is the pleasure of the committee? President Olberg?
Move to adopt the substitute, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have a motion before us to adopt committee substitute for House Bill number 81. Is there discussion? President Cott?
Well, for the purpose of procedure, I have an amendment here that's going to amend House Bill 81. And procedurally, am I still amending 81 once we adopt the substitute, or am I amending the committee substitute?
You'd be amending the committee substitute. If we adopt the committee substitute first.
Okay.
All right. If there's no further discussion, would the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Pete Cott?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Fran Ulmer?
No.
Representative Betty Davis?
No.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Albizzi.
Yes. We have before us committee substitute for House Bill number 81. There's discussion or opinion. Cott, you said you had an amendment.
Yes, I'll pass. Very simple amendment. While you're cruising, I'll explain it. Essentially, this is the ratcheting down program that trims 5% off the original amount on an annual basis, starting on the fiscal year. In other words, first year, it'd be a reduction of $12.50 down to $237.50. The second year, it'd be $225. And right on through until the year 2009, at which point the program would be phased out completely. Now, you'll notice on the chart, it doesn't have the same effect at the very beginning, but as you move it through the out years and continue it beyond 2008, you'll see that the savings are then brought into light. The reason why I feel that this is a fair plan is that it is equitable. It treats all seniors alike. For those that have been in the state for 62 years, it offers them an opportunity to get into the program at a reduced rate. In other words, if they're 62 today, 3 years, they're going to find a $37.50 cut, so they're going to get whatever that is, $222.50. I think secondarily, it will deter people that might be coming to the state for this particular bonus. In 4 or 5 years, when you're below $200, I really don't believe that anyone could justify coming to the state for that small amount of money. And that is not reflected in the fiscal analysis. I'm sure we can reduce the numbers of folks that are coming up here. I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Does the committee have any questions of Representative Cott's amendment? Representative Ulmer?
Let me just make sure if I understand this, tell me if I'm wrong. Anybody can get in if they've been here a year
the same,
or 65.
Yeah.
No,
we haven't changed
ratcheting
any
down in terms of which year you arrive or which
That's
year
correct.
You turn 65. It just reduces the amount of a monthly bonus across the board for everybody the same.
That's correct.
5% per year. And when it terminates, there's
perspective, it offers, we've talked about long-term plans and short-term plans, and it offers some opportunity for those seniors that are currently out there receiving this particular amount of money, or who's not receiving it, say, are 63, an opportunity to plan for their future. They don't have a lot of opportunities at 65 years old or 63. I think this is at least a gesture that will afford them some opportunity to plan ahead. Case in point could be you have two seniors that have been in the state, let's say they're lifelong residents, been here before statehood, 63 or 64 years old. They're going to both turn 65 January and February of next year. They're counting on this $250, and it's been around forever, it seems like. Because of the low interest rates that are out there today, they go out and make a capital purchase. Now they're finding out that, oops, too bad, too sad. So they've made a commitment that they're going to have to live up to, and they may find themselves under a way.
Okay, what we have before us is an amendment. Takes a different approach from the committee substitute we just adopted. The effect of the amendment is that we have a slight reduction in the cost, projected cost of the longevity bonus program in fiscal year 94. That's slightly above fiscal year 93. The amendment before us, the program terminates in the year 2009 at a total cost to the state of $803 million. The committee substitute as before us would not actuarially terminate for many years after that. However, the costs become quite small after the year 2010. The total cost of the committee substitute for us isn't on the table, but it would be very close to the total cost of the amendment that is before us. It's two different approaches to the same thing, the same problem. Is there further comment on the amendment proposed by Representative Cox? Representative Sanders.
I have one question. Does anyone know what it costs to administer this program? How many people are involved and what the cost is?
I'm sure that's comparable cost.
I believe that we had some information on that, but I don't remember what it is.
I mean, currently, because what I'm getting at is in the way this is in 2007, we'll be sending out $50 checks, which are worth $20 in a day's money, and we'll be paying just as much for the overhead as we are today.
It costs just as much to send out a $50.
Or more, a lot more, because they'll all have raises then and be making more money.
But the point is, it won't cost any more to send out a $250 check or a $50 check. I mean, it's going to be the same.
Why don't we
change the number? We're reducing the two, making it from $250 or $225 to $50. It's going to cost the same.
Yeah, but we have the same overhead. That's what I mean. We're just selling a little token. $50 then will only be worth like $20 today, and we're spending just as much money to
send
out.
Under the plan and in the amendment is labeled D, you're writing a lot more checks for smaller amounts of money. That's correct.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm getting at. You know, it's going to cost, the overhead's going to be a lot higher. And the people aren't getting anything. I mean, they're getting $20 more than they're getting if they don't get nothing.
Further discussion, or somebody wish to call a question? I'll call for the question. If there's no further discussion on the proposed amendment, would the
Representative amendment move?
Yes, I understood Representative Cott to move the amendment for $1.
Yeah.
What's before us is a motion to amend committee substitute for House Bill Number 81. The amendment, in essence, deletes all the text in the bill before us and adopts new text. Would the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Can I have a question again? I'm sorry, I was
struggling.
What's the question again?
The question is, there is an amendment by Representative Cott.
Oh, it's about the amendment.
Yes, we're voting on whether to adopt the amendment.
No.
Representative Harley Olberg.
No.
Representative Fran Ulmer.
No.
Representative Pete Cott.
Yes.
And Representative Albizu.
No. The amendment is not adopted. We have before us committee substitute for House Bill number 81. There is not further discussion. I will call the question. Hearing none, would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Albizzi?
Yes.
Representative Fran Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Betty Davis?
No.
Representative Pete Cott?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
House Bill, Committee Substitute for House Bill 81 has passed out of the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations. I thank everybody. I don't know of any bill that we have spent more time on in this, and I hope we don't see any more like it. So. The next item on our agenda, is Representative Nordland here? I don't see him. Okay, I thought Representative Nordland was going to be here this morning. Joseph, would you call Representative Nordland's office, see if he was going to be here this morning? I may have confused him yesterday. I might have told him Saturday.
What exactly the bill number?
I'm sorry. That's not Representative Nordland's bill. Yes, I am confused. This is Representative Betty Davis's bill.
Because I didn't know that he was on their schedule.
Okay. I am confused. HCR 1 is Representative Betty Davis's bill. I thought Representative Nordland was responsible. House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 is a bill proposing to amend the uniform rules of the Alaska State Legislature. Representative Davis is the prime sponsor of this bill. Would you like to make a sponsor statement?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to my colleagues. The bill that you have before you is an opportunity for you to adopt something that would affect only the legislators and have no effect on the public in the sense that there's no physical notes. It will not impact anyone else's lives but ours. The Speaker Pro Tem is a position that is being held in many states. About 37 states have what they call a Speaker Pro Tem. However, the duties vary throughout the states as to what they might do. As you read the amendment, the proposal that I have before you is to create another leadership position. I think it's a timely bill at this time because as we talk about term limitations, and having people to leave the legislators in a shorter number of times that would give more opportunity to hold a leadership role. And as I can see from my experiences in looking at materials from other states, it's also a great opportunity for women to move into the leadership role. A lot of times throughout the legislature, there's a hard time getting into some of the leadership role for women because they are new into this business and sometimes don't have the experience that is needed. It's sometimes called a training position. The duties that they would have would be those designated by the speaker. And in my proposal, they will take over when the speaker is not able to perform her duties. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to take them at this time. But I think it's a bill that's past its time for the state, and I would like for you to give it favorable consideration out of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Are there any questions of Representative Davis? Representative Davis, I have a couple of questions. The first one is, can you tell me, and I don't want to pick on you, I'm picking on myself
here. I don't want you to pick on me either.
we spell the phrase pro tempore. Why do we pronounce it pro tem? Never having taken.
I'm not able to answer that for you.
Representative Olberg, you're a Latin.
Maybe someone else can.
Because we can never decide whether to say pro tempore or tempore, so we don't say anything.
Okay. No Latin experts in our community.
No, I don't have any questions.
Right. My other question is, I understand your bill to establish the permanent position of the presiding officer pro tem. But the old saying is, it's not broke, don't fix it. Why do we want to amend this rule? What is wrong with our current system that would cause us to want to amend our rule?
I have heard the saying, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But there's a chance to have a more efficient way to conduct business and provide more of an opportunity for people to serve in those kinds of capacities. I think that's something that we should look at. is something that has worked in 37 states, and other states seem to be moving to it, and those that don't have it have what they call deputy speakers. I prefer not to have a deputy speaker, and since we already have a position in there to say that we have a temporary one, and the only thing that temporary pro tem is doing at this time is presiding during the time that we are getting ready to place the speaker in place. And it's just for that one day only. And since it's already there, all we are doing now is expanding the duties of that position and giving the opportunity to fill it. It would be up to the leadership to decide if they wanted to fill it or not, but at least the change that we are making would allow that to happen. And that's why I want it. It's not so much that things are perfect the way we have them. I don't think they are. It's not trying to fix something that broke. What we have worked, but we can make it work better with this change.
President Olberg?
Under the present system, if the speaker is unable to preside, who does?
The majority leader takes over. And that's where I see majority role is a serious role anyway. They have their own duties to take over. So if the speaker's not there and the majority leader has to take over, then who takes over the majority leader's position? So you're moving somebody in that position anyway. So we don't have a perfect setup. This setup would be even better because this person would have just those duties that have been assigned to them by the speaker to perform at the pleasure of the speaker.
So that under today's system, if the majority leader becomes the presiding officer in the absence of the speaker, whoever is performing the function of the majority leader may have never set foot in that
That's
place
right.
before.
That's true.
I've often wondered about this.
Right. It's not always that it happened, but it does happen.
If that were...
Representative
Cox? Chair, if that were the case today, whereby the majority leader took over the speaker position, wouldn't it be most likely to find the majority whip?
It could.
Pulling the majority...
Mr. Chairman, who is the majority whip?
I don't think we have one.
I'm sorry. The majority whip is Mark Hanley.
I didn't know that.
Yes. He doesn't get a seat of honor as does the minority whip.
The majority whips usually don't have a seat of honor because, first of all, it's more like a ceremony thing, and the duties are varied according to what the majority leader might want them to perform. And so you might have a whip and several deputies to work, and all they're doing is going around counting votes mostly. But what has happened out of the 2 years that I've been here, it's been the ruse chair that's moved into that position. When the majority leader was performing the speaker's duty, the ruse chair moved in and filled in the majority leader's duties. There's nothing in writing to say that it has to be that way. It could be anyone.
Representative Olmer?
Jim, I might just note that in other states where they use the pro tem, the speaker pro tem serves a lot of the ceremonial functions that the speaker has to do in the state. So it kind of takes off some of the workload of the speaker because it's almost like a lieutenant governor position. A lot of things where the speaker has to appear.
No, it's more
did I say the wrong thing?
Yeah, you did.
Anyway, kind of, the ribbon cutting and the speech making and the helping out to make things smoothly flow, that does get done by the speaker pro tem in a lot of other states. I've been to a lot of meetings where the speaker pro tem has been there standing in for the speaker because the speaker couldn't be there. I mean, that's what happens in that position.
It is. Mr. Chairman, it is the title and a position that is highly coveted by other states. The legislators see that as a real leadership role. I did not want to create this just for ceremonial, but if they want to give them some of those duties, that's fine. But as you can see by what I have proposed to you, this would be more than ceremonial. This person will be serving in absence of the speaker, taking over the speaker's duties when the speaker is not able to perform them, along with other duties that might be assigned by the speaker.
In other words, they wouldn't just be a keeper of the gavel.
No.
Further comments, discussion? Does the committee wish to take action on this or hold it over for further consideration? motion before us to pass House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 from the House State Affairs Committee. I'll assume that you would endorse that with individual recommendations. Further discussion? Not with the committee secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Albizzi?
Yes.
Representative Pete Cott?
Yes.
Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Fran Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olber?
Yes.
With that, the House Concurrent Resolution Number 1 has passed from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations. The next item on our agenda is House Bill 119, an act authorizing the court to impose day fines instead of sentence imprisonment. The prime sponsor of that bill is Representative Ulmer. Representative Ulmer, would you care to make a sponsor statement?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 119 attempts to deal with a serious problem Alaska has, which is prison overcrowding and a rising crime population. I've served on the Sentencing Commission for the last 2.5 years, and I want to share very briefly with you that not only does Alaska have a problem now, but it's going to have an even more serious problem in the years to come based on what we know about demographics and what's happening in our criminal population. We have roughly, I think we have 12 institutions in Alaska right now that house criminal offenders. According to the Department of Corrections 2 days ago, 10 out of the 12 are at emergency overcrowding conditions. Our prisons are full. And yet we have roughly 900 misdemeanants waiting to serve their time. They're being told that they can't serve their time until next September. We have a serious problem, and we have to come up with some creative alternatives. House Bill 119 attempts to come up with one creative alternative, and it is a much more aggressive system of fining misdemeanants than we do right now. This idea of day fines is not a new one. Other states do it, other nations do it, and what it is basically is that you pay a fine based on what your daily salary is. And so it has a way of taking a much bigger bite out of your pocket than our current fining systems do. In your packet, you will find a document that was prepared by the court system. It's a very in-depth discussion of day fines. I won't take the committee's time to go through that, but I hope you've had an opportunity to take a look at it. There's also a publication from the National Institute of Justice, Crimes, Fines as Criminal Sanctions, which describes for you why the National Institute of Justice is recommending that states adopt day fine systems as an alternative to simply building more prisons. This bill would not have any violent offenders be eligible for a day fine system. We're only talking about property crimes, not person crimes. We're only talking about misdemeanors. We're not talking about felonies. And it would be within the judge's discretion as to whether or not the day fine system approach would be used, or whether or not the offender would get probation, or whether or not the offender should go to prison. So that it gives the judge the discretion to decide whether or not that is an appropriate alternative to prison. And in some cases it will be, in some cases it won't be. It's not an across-the-board alternative for everybody by any means, but it is an option that I believe the judiciary of Alaska should have. If you would turn to one section of the bill, I think the meat of the bill is on page 3, section 5. The new language added in Section 5 basically describes for you how the day fine system works. The Supreme Court would adopt the day fine plan. In other words, we're asking the court to come up with the details of how the system would work. But on page 4, it tells you basically what the formula is in subsection C. The amount of a day fine shall be the product of the net daily income adjusted for the number of attendants times the day fine penalty. So there would be a proportionality associated with the ability to pay of the offender. And I think that's the key to this idea, that obviously if somebody's making $50,000 a year and they get a $250 fine, it hits them a lot differently than somebody who's only making $10,000. So the proportionality associated with day fines is to make the penalty take the same amount of a bite out of everybody's pocket that gets treated to this particular penalty. I believe that there is a representative of the court system here, Mr. Chairman, who is prepared to testify on the bill, and I'll also be happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions of Representative Ulmer at this time? Representative Sanders?
How does this apply to people who don't show any income? A lot of people who commit a lot of crimes in this state don't have any income.
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, most of them at least have a permanent fund dividend. So the permanent fund dividend is something that is instantly available for the day fine system. And
that's
it is amazing how many people actually have some income, even though they may not say that they have income.
Well, I mean, they hide it.
Well, it will be up to the court to determine, to make a determination as to what the individual's actual income is. And the court has to do the research that basically, in other words, the defendant's word will simply not be taken at face value, whether or not they have income or not. The court will have the opportunity to determine whether or not, for example, in December, maybe the guy doesn't have any income, but perhaps he fishes June, July, and August. And so the court will be able to take income in the future that this person would have during the June, July, and August if the court determines that this guy's a sane fisherman and they have a reasonable expectation in the future to be able to pay their fine. If the court determines that the person really has no income at all, then this option won't be used and the person will either get probation or go to jail. So it's only an option. It is not replacing the existing sanctions. It's only another choice that the judge has if he or she decides it's appropriate.
Representative Cott?
So if we had a particular case where whereby there was a mandatory jail sentence, this did not apply.
That's right.
Like in DWIs.
Not apply,
required
there's
three days.
Other language in the statute that says it is mandatory.
And you don't feel by sorting out who's able to save and who's not able to save is going to be discriminatory, and therefore those who have wealth get the lock free and those who have none are in jail.
Well, Mr.
If I could interrupt, Representative Ulmer is, I'm sure, very knowledgeable on this subject, probably more so than the other members of the committee. However, we do have representatives of the court system there, and they are professionals in this area, and would probably, I think Representative Ulmer would concur, can probably comment with a little more expertise. And I think I will say also this committee will rely heavily upon the counsel of the Judiciary Committee on issues of constitutionality. Yes, Mr. Christensen, if you would state your name and affiliation for the record, and if you have some comments you'd like to make on this bill, and then we do have questions of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, staff counsel to the Judicial Branch. The Supreme Court does support the concept presented by this piece of legislation. As Representative Ulmer has indicated, it provides courts with more sentencing discretion for certain kinds of misdemeanor cases. As we see it, this will provide two basic advantages for the state of Alaska. The first, Representative Ulmer has gone into, by providing judges with more sentencing discretion, we may help alleviate the problem we have with our prisons. I think the second advantage is that it is impossible to estimate right now, this bill probably will result in substantial additional sums of money being brought into the general fund each year. Right now, the court system collects about $4 million a year in criminal fines. The Attorney General collects an additional amount, I believe it's several $1 million additionally. We don't know how much this will increase if this bill were to take effect, but it probably would be a substantial increase. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that members might have about the process.
My first question is be how many misdemeanor prison man days do we have a year? How many days of imprisonment are involved here?
Mr. Chairman, that's something that perhaps the Department of Corrections would be better able to answer.
Well, I mean, they house them, but it's the court system that puts them there. I mean, I don't know that the corrections really cares whether
sure.
They're misdemeanors or felons or...
But Mr. Chairman, I think part of the problem is the court might impose a sentence, but that sentence is not what the person ends up serving because they're entitled to some days of good time, and that will depend on how much of their jail sentence they're good for. They're entitled to discretionary parole, which is different. So the actual number of days that somebody serves is very different than the number of days imposed by a judge. And we generally don't know the number of days that are actually served.
No, I'm aware of that. That is handled through the Department of Corrections as to how to, when a person is released, is not a court order.
That's correct.
Okay.
Further questions? I'd like to have him address the question that was asked by Representative Cott.
Would you care to repeat your
question,
Representative
Cott? Well, it just seems to me that in many of these cases, if the court finds that someone is indigent and there's no opportunity to attach a lien on their wages, as in the case of being an accountant, there's no choice but to incarcerate this person. And it seems like this is another classical case where this system is built by oven for the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cott, under the current system, and not just the system used in Alaska, but the system used anywhere, the legislature will set a maximum dollar amount for a fine for a particular crime. In Alaska, the maximum fine for Class A misdemeanor is $5,000. But what judges generally do is they hit all similarly situated defendants, you know, all, say, first-time offenders, with the same level of fine. And very typically for a Class A misdemeanor, depending on what misdemeanor it is, everyone will get hit with a $250 fine if it's their first offense. And the reason they pick $250 is because that's the amount that the poorest defendant is considered able to afford. This bill recognizes the fact that there are many defendants out there who can afford more. It would charge them more. I would expect that if you do have the truly indigent, they would still be hit with that minimum $250 fine. They would not be told, you know, either you pay $1,000 or you get put in jail. That alternative wouldn't be given. It would be given that minimum. And the reality is, under our current system, and I expect under this new system, these truly indigent who get the $250 fines either end up not paying it or it gets taken out of their permanent fund dividend. The legislature did put a law in the books some years back which said that we can take 100% of a dividend to pay a criminal fine or restitution for a criminal.
And which would come first? Using the permanent fund dividend to pay the fine or to pay the attorney fees that we are also addressing. We're hearing a lot about permanent fund. And the way I've got it figured out, we're about minus $20 right now. I mean, everybody wants a piece of the pie, and there's no more pieces left.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, the statute set forth a priority list of what order things can be taken out of a person's dividend. And I think there are about five items. I think number one on the list is child support. After that comes a restitution for the victims of a crime. After that comes fines for a criminal act. And after that comes any other debt owed to a state agency. And it's a debt owed to a state agency where the public defender fees would fall into. And, you know, the truth is, when you've got a typical criminal defendant, they probably very likely owe back child support. And they definitely fall into the other categories. They've usually got a fine, they've usually got restitution, and they've usually got a public defender. The way the court system deals with this is that when someone comes in and owes this kind of money, we force them to sign an assignment of their permanent fund dividend checks for however many years in the future it will be expected them to pay this amount. And if they refuse to sign the assignment, the clerk of court signs the assignment for them, and it's sent off to the Department of Revenue. And then for the next 3 or 4 years, until the debt's paid off, the check is seized. The Office of the Attorney General does have a fines collection office funded through program receipts, and all they do, or 90% of what they do, is seize permanent fund dividends to repay all these sorts of debts. It's an efficient operation, and it does bring in a lot of money for the state each year.
Is there not, I might follow up, is there not a current system in place whereby the judge really has the opportunity within his own court to establish a day fine system? I mean, or are we just tightening up and making it obligatory to the courts in this particular case with this piece of legislation? It's no longer an option.
Through the chair, Representative Ulmer can correct me, but I believe there was a statute passed several years ago that said that we couldn't look at the current ability to pay when we established a criminal fine. So there are current laws in the book that actually need to be changed for us to implement this policy.
Mr. Chairman, that is true, and it's also true that the fine So the judge really doesn't have very much discretion. If he sees a defendant in front of him who he knows is quite capable of paying more, he can't just say, you know, you drove up to the courtroom this morning in a Jaguar, so your fine's going to be $10,000. He can't do that because the statute's restrictive. So we need to put in place a system like this, which gives the court the ability to come up with a new schedule. Otherwise, their hands are tied.
Also, Mr. Chairman, if I may, an additional problem under the current system is that this would be left to the discretion of each individual judge, which, you know, will result in similarly situated defendants being treated differently. Under the day fine bill, a schedule would be established that all judges would have to follow so that similarly situated defendants were treated the same way. Their income would be determined the same way and the fines would be the same way.
I have a couple questions, Mr. Christian. One is, we go into court on a misdemeanor case, and a person has a right to a trial by jury, Class A misdemeanor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If they can get a jail sentence, if they can get a fine greater than $300, or if you can take away a valuable license, such as their limited entry permit, they're entitled to a trial by jury.
We go through this procedure and end up finding somebody $250, and what is the cost to the state of Alaska? Typical average trial, misdemeanor trial?
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman. It's hard to figure out, but I think it's a lot greater than $250. For example, a misdemeanor trial, you would have a jury of six people who get paid $25 a day each, and you might, for a typical misdemeanor trial, the jury will be there for one day. So that's $150. Then, of course, you have the overhead of the courthouse and the judge and the in-court clerk and all the other clerks who handle the paperwork. Then you have the cost to the public defender agency for representing this person. The costs are generally substantially greater than you're able to collect in fines.
You don't happen to know how many hours you actually hold court a year in the state of Alaska, do you?
No, Mr. Chairman.
My other question is, I can personally remember it was very common to receive sentences of $250 or 5 days in jail. It was up to the defendant. And I believe it was in the mid-70s that the Supreme Court threw that out. Are we going into that area? And I'll be very honest, I'm going to defer to the Judiciary Department to evaluate the constitutional aspects of this. But it does seem to me that we're trying to come in the back door and get where we were, same place we were 20 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of what you said is that the courts thought it was inappropriate, constitutionally inappropriate, to give somebody an option, you know, pay money or go to jail. I think the difference here is that under the day fine bill, they're not really being given that option. They're going to be charged what they can afford to pay. And if they can't afford to pay anything, they're not going to be thrown in jail. They're just going to be given a very, very small amount that, in theory, anyone can afford to pay, and which will be taken out of their permanent fund dividend. So I don't think we're going to be placed in a situation.
We've already determined that everybody else has already got their permanent fund check, so.
Right.
Representative Sanders.
Are these the only two physical notes there are with this? Just the public defender and the public advocacy?
The court system distributed one this week.
Did they? I haven't seen it.
Again, Mr. Chairman, we expect an $80,000 cost the first year.
Oh, that's better, but I just couldn't imagine how you'd say you're going to do all this for nothing.
No, yeah. No. And then a $35,000 a year ongoing cost, which is, I would suspect, that just a tiny, tiny fraction of the extra fines that would be brought in during the course of a year.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just had a flash of something. I recall being told earlier this year that if you add up all the cases that the court system considers in a year and divide it by our total budget, it comes out to something like $600 per case. Which is relatively efficient, then I think the reason it sounds like such a good number is because the vast majority of people who get charged with crimes plead guilty. They don't actually go to trial. The trial rate is under 12%. But
I could still, I can't even see one person doing this. I can see a great deal of difficulty trying to find out how much money people actually make I'd see a lot of people trying to figure that out in the next few years. There's so many people who, especially people who are into criminal activity, who don't have any income. And then, like the chairman said, they're the ones that are going to use the courts and drag this thing out and get a jury trial and everything else more than ever.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, there's some dispute about the figures, but I've been told that as many as probably in excess of 80% of all the criminals who are arrested and actually charged end up getting a public defender or representation by the Office of Public Advocacy. And in each of these cases, the figure is perhaps as high as 90%. And right now, in each of these cases, the court has to determine their income level before we can determine that they're indigent and order a public defender. So that is actually something we're doing right now in another way. In about 90% of these cases, we do have an affidavit, a multi-page income report form that people have to fill out, that they have to sign under oath. And we do do what investigation we can afford to do to make sure they're not lying about it. Last year we had a pilot project where we were pulling credit reports from a credit bureau, for example. But actually determining income is something that we do at this time for maybe 85 or 90% of all the employees.
Can you just do it by having people sign under oath?
That's primarily how we do it. In the big cities.
Assume that people who steal don't lie?
Well, many of them do.
All
them
are thieves, or what?
And that's why last year we adopted a court rule that said if the public defender is representing somebody and he discovers that the person lied to us, he's got to withdraw from representation. In the past, they didn't do that because they felt that was unethical. So we're ordering them to do that now.
Representative Ulmer.
Mr. Chairman, I might just direct the attention of the committee. In the back of the day fines report prepared by the court system is an appendix, and in appendix A, B, and C, you will find the day fines program for Staten Island, New York, Phoenix, Arizona, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There's also a fair amount of work that's been done analyzing the day fine system in Europe, which uses fines to a much greater extent than America does. We incarcerate people who commit crimes. Europe fines them to death. Takes away their cars, takes away their houses, takes away their salaries. We've made the choice to lock people up without thinking about the cost to society for locking people up costs. I mean, when you're looking at $30,000 a year per person to spend a year in prison, we're picking up the tab. And this idea is that the criminal would pick up the tab instead. So think about this bill as an opportunity for at least in part, freeing up some necessary bed space for really violent offenders, which we're running out of, providing an opportunity for the person who's committed the crime to pay back society as opposed to our paying for his room and board for as long as he'll be in prison, and just providing another option for judges. It's not mandatory. It's not being forced on anybody. It's an option that the judge can consider if they think it's appropriate. So that's what the bill does, and I think it will save us money.
Further comments or questions of Mr. Christensen? Representative Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ulmer, are you familiar with any other? This is, I like this approach. However, the sentencing and I think the whole criminal sentencing system needs a lot of attention. And are you aware of any other bills that might be an omnibus relating to the sentencing report that might?
The House Judiciary Committee that is working on, I guess, looking at which of the recommendations from the Sentencing Commission that subcommittee would feel comfortable with, and I don't think they've reached conclusions on that yet, so I'm not sure when, even if, there will be an omnibus bill seriously considered. There are a number of other things that have been recommended by the Sentencing Commission that will definitely ultimately ease prison overcrowding and reduce the cost of corrections. This is the one idea that has the most immediate promise. Having served on the commission, I can tell you I've thought a lot about it. This one has the most immediate payback to the state, taking the pressure off the corrections and providing money back into the treasury instead of out of the treasury. And that's why I decided to introduce this bill, because I thought maybe at least this one idea out of the Sentencing Commission report, because it would have the most immediate payback to the state, ought to move forward as quickly as possible.
standard.
You say this bill applies only to crimes against property, not crimes against people?
Let's look at the...
It only applies to misdemeanors. There's no violent assault type crimes that are misdemeanors.
Yeah, I'll find you a section that... Margaret, if you can help find a section that clarifies that it's not for violent misdemeanors.
Mr. Chairman, on the bright side, based on what they pay us, we're never going to have to pay much in the way of a fine.
That's right. Besides that, we've already determined that political campaigns aren't subject to this, so...
Oh, right.
Representative Sanders, if you look on page 3, line 24, upon conviction of a misdemeanor other than a violation of 1141 and 1141...
Page which?
Page 3, line 24.
What is 1141?
Other than 1141, 1141 describe all of the violent misdemeanor offenses.
Boy, it's easy to put something like that past me.
Well,
put a number
Margaret
down.
Hadn't been here to help me find it this morning, I would have missed it too, but that is where it is.
I would say one other thing. In general, I think I'm for this. I'm just trying to pick it apart because I don't want to see another big bureaucratic nightmare made up out of it. But I believe that a poor person's time isn't worth a lot more to him than a rich person's money. And a lot of people might disagree with that, but I mean, these people who have money spend a lot of their time getting it, and maybe they have too much money, but the poor people have too much time. So I think it's a pretty even trade-off to charge a date money. I kind of like that.
If I may just comment, we are really just beginning, I think, to wrestle very seriously with a corrections program in the state of Alaska, which we simply cannot afford. I'm not going to comment too much on this bill. It's a complicated bill, and I am still learning about it. It does seem to go in the direction that we are going to have to go whether we want to or not. Mr. Christensen, if there are any more questions of you, I appreciate your time being with us this morning, and thank you very much. Are there persons present in the committee room that would like to testify on HB 119? Seeing none, if there's not, President Codd, did you have some?
I just got one comment regarding the subcommittee, the Judiciary Subcommittee in the House that's evaluating the recommendations by the Sentencing Commission. As a member of that commission, I can pretty much substantiate that this is one of the items that we've looked very favorably in regards to cutting costs and doing things a little bit different in the state of Alaska. We have evaluated all the recommendations, and I would submit that you probably will not see an omnibus bill in the House. You'll see something in the Senate. But we have rather sorted all the recommendations out between us, and for all the ones that have already been introduced, they're going to just carried by the sponsor. This is one that was looked at favorably. So,
okay.
So with that, I would move that we pass this out of committee. With individual recommendations.
Okay. President Codd has moved we pass this bill out of committee. If the committee would like to do so, that's the pleasure of the committee. If the committee would like a few more days to review it, comments or possible amendments, they can vote no on the motion, but unless there's strenuous objections, I see no reason why we shouldn't entertain a motion to move it out of the committee. Would the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Fran Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Peacock?
Yes.
And Representative Albizzi?
Yes. House Bill 119 is passed out of the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations, and the next committee of referral is the Judiciary Committee. Next item on our agenda is House Bill 142, sponsored by Representative Ulmer. Representative Ulmer, would you care to make a sponsor statement?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to keep my remarks very brief because there are members of the public who are here to testify on 911, and I'd like to give my time to them because they've very patiently been sitting here. But basically, the bill deals with the 911 emergency reporting system and puts in motion a system whereby an expanded and enhanced 911 emergency system can be put in place for all know the importance of the 911 emergency system in the state of Alaska. There are some inadequacies in the way in which it's working now, and this program, I think, is a way of enhancing it. And with that, I would just as soon turn to the folks from the fire and police departments.
Oh, okay. Well, before we do that, I'm going to exercise my prerogative as chairman, and I'm going to call for a brief addie.
Okay.
All right. Back to order at 9 o'clock a.m. This is Bill March 11th, 1993, House State Affairs Committee meeting. We have persons, I have a person signed in to testify on House Bill 142. I believe it's Mr. John, is it Georgia?
George.
George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John George. I'm representing the Alaska State Firefighters Association, the Alaska State Fire Chiefs Association today. I believe Mr. Larry Fanning, who is the coordinating fire chief for the Juneau Fire Departments, will also like to testify on this. But we really support the concept of enhanced 911 program throughout the state. The problem is getting funding to put in the equipment. And Representative Ulmer has been kind enough to submit a bill which would allow a funding mechanism so that communities can take advantage of the enhanced 911 system. Some of the advantages are it gives the dispatcher a lot more information. And when someone calls in and they're incapacitated or they're a young child, they may not know their address. They may not know their name. In the enhanced 911 system, you can also put in emergency information. If you have a diabetic at home or you have an elderly person, that information can show up on the screen at the dispatcher's office so that they can give a more proper response. So we think it's a great program. We need a funding mechanism, and this bill provides that funding mechanism. We do have some proposed amendments, and Chief Fanning will be giving one of them. But the Senate had a similar bill, and they amended it so that the money could go directly to municipalities from the phone company. We think it makes a lot of sense to do that, in that it cuts out some of the bureaucracy and accounting for the money with the state, and municipalities having to go back to the state and get an appropriation through the legislature to get the money that was paid by their citizens for their enhanced 911 system. So we would encourage you to consider amending this bill to something similar to what the Senate has done with that. Chief Fanning will also talk about a minor change which allows some additional types of equipment to be procured. But we have to answer any questions that you have.
Are there questions of Mr. George? Mr. George, I have a few questions, and I look upon the bill, and it looks like more of a tariff than it would anything else. Do I understand the bill correctly?
That is the procedure. The phone company would charge the 50 cents per line charge, collect that, because they do collect on phone bills, and then remit that. So I think that's correct. It would be
has anybody gone through and determined, does that generate the revenues that are needed to support this kind of system?
Yeah.
What I'm afraid of is that if it's too much money, why, that's okay. I'm sure they can find a good place to put it. But if it's not enough, we put in statute what the tariff is. And, these people might be legislated out of the 911 system.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, if it's too much money, there are very specific things that the money can be spent for. So that money can't just be spent for new fire trucks or whatever. It has to go into the 911 enhanced system maintenance operation and equipment. As far as not being enough, 50 cents per line is a whole lot more money than we're getting now. And I think that, you know, really is the gist of the question. Senator or Representative Bundy has introduced a bill that has a two-level funding. It's very similar to this bill, with 50 cents for large communities and I believe 75 cents for smaller communities to generate more revenue for smaller communities. I guess I don't have any objection to that. I really don't have a feeling for whether that's enough or too much. My indications are that 50 cents is an acceptable level.
Representative Olberg?
Yes, Representative Bundy's bill was heard in my committee Tuesday, and somebody from Anchorage, and I can't say exactly who, testified that his bill at 50 cents for large communities would raise, I think, $800,000 a year, and administration overhead in the 911 system was like $1 million, I think it was $1.8 million, $1.9 million. And because of that. In fact, the first thing I did when I got this bill was to highlight the 50 cents. I think it ought to be a dollar. And I don't think they're, well, this bill doesn't provide for it, but in the discussion between small community, large community, and how much is 911 really worth, you know, how much is your life worth? Most people would pay a buck a month without. Most people would pay more than that, I suspect, but I would recommend that it be increased.
You say you have heard another bill number?
It's 166.
And we are a committee referral on that bill, too, if I remember correctly. It's on our list. What is the status of Bill 1, House Bill 166 and the community?
An amendment was being worked on. We're hearing it again today. It was very favorably received. I don't know how it compares with this, but attempts to accomplish the same purpose. And possibly we could get it out of there and over here, and I don't know what the protocol is.
You would be prepared to give us, at that time, an analysis of a comparison of the two bills and how they address the same?
No.
Well, so much for trying to be smooth. Representative Ulmer?
Mr. Chairman, I might just note that with regard to both ideas that have been put on the table, the amendment that would have the money go directly to the municipalities and the idea of a larger surcharge, I am certainly open to the committee doing both of those and preparing a CS to reflect that.
Further comments? Questions? Are there other persons present who wish to testify on HB 142? Mr. Fanning?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Larry Fanning, the fire chief of City of Juneau. The amendment that I would like to suggest to the committee has to do with looking at this E911 as a system. And that's to add verbiage for essential communications equipment. So what we have is an emergency that happens. The call is generated to the public safety answering point. And from that point on, the emergency units, that's where the build stops right now. There's another step that needs to be done to complete the system, and that's to notify the emergency responding units of the incidents so they can respond back to complete the loop. So looking at E911 as a system, emergency happens, the telephone call comes in to the public safety answering point, the PSAP. The PSAP then will alert the emergency responding units to go back to the emergency site to render the aid or give whatever is necessary. And with that systematic look at the situation on page 6 of House Bill 142, I'd like to suggest an amendment under, I guess it's paragraph 7, and that's to add after line 9, where it says with call detail recording semicolon and other essential communication equipment.
Okay, well, obviously you're not in a position to introduce an amendment, but I'm sure that one or more of the members of this committee would be really glad to talk to you about introducing that. President Olberg.
Mr. Chairman, if in fact we could get House Bill 166 over here, I would be happy to volunteer to serve on a subcommittee, perhaps consisting of Representative Olmer, and I don't know if it would be appropriate for Representative Bundy to sit in and I could referee or how that works.
I thought I made a suggestion in that direction a minute ago and got rebuked.
Well, consider it a delayed reaction, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Olberg. Are there further questions of Ms. Fanning? Representative Olberg.
Just one quick question. Do you have any idea how many calls come in either in Juneau or statewide under the emergency system? Just to give us a little more feel for how the system might be operating now and how it might be improved upon.
Well, through the chair, Representative Olmer, I can tell you about the situation in Juneau. I think that there are probably around 20,000 emergency calls a year that come through the police department. The issue with Juneau is that completing that system again is the calls that are coming into Juneau are not through an E911 system, it's through 911, which means there's an automatic number identification. The telephone number shows up on the screen, but not the automatic location indicator. It's Annie and Allie. Annie's the number, the telephone number. Allie is a location indicator, gives the exact address and where the incident occurs. So what happens is if the caller says, I'm having a heart attack, hangs down the hook, the number may be displayed there, but then there's a lot of work that needs to be done to find out where exactly is that number attached to, going back to the telephone company. The other advantages of having an E911 system, as what was talked about by John George, is that a database can be established if the end user so would desire to say that Larry Fanning's grandmother resides in the house who has certain medical problems, that should the call come in, it can be pulled up right on the screen so the first responders can be made aware of that. Or if that particular residence has hazardous materials on it and a call is called, it can be brought up right away on the screen for dispatching the unit. The other issue is that, whether it's a topographical configuration of the community, is that the one public safety answering point is that Juneau cannot dispatch to all the fire and emergency responding units throughout the whole borough. We need to increase the backbone, like I said, to complete that unit, to come around to have a real successful E911 system. The other part of an E911 system will bring up a display on the board that if Larry Fanning has a heart attack, the dispatcher can look at the screen and give the caller and say, fine, make sure Larry's airway is open, his heart is beating, leave things, emergency units are on their way. So some pre-information, arrival information that can be given to the caller to help them with the emergency situation until units get there.
Do you have any idea what it would cost just in Juneau to complete the rest of that system?
$2.3 million in hardware. And that's no staffing.
Just equipment. Thanks.
My understanding of this bill is that it carries a zero fiscal note because it's just establishing a tariff. It doesn't call for actually doing anything. Am I mistaken? Okay. Further questions? Representative Scott?
Does this tariff or so-called surcharge, which goes into a special fund, constitute a dedication of revenue and therefore perhaps be a violation of the Constitution?
Well, that's the way tariffs always work, so somehow they work. I haven't heard the question of the constitutionality of
the tariffs. I mean, we've seen ATUC and how they've done it when they established, when the legislature established the tariff there, or tax, or whatever you could use it last session. And that's a little bit different, at least in my understanding of how this is being done.
Representative Cott, you were next. Representative Olberg, you were next.
I suspect the fact that the fee is being collected by a non-government agency, probably. In other words, the state government never gets their hands on the money, as I understand how the system works. It's collected by the phone company and goes back to the municipality.
Representative Olmer?
That is the recommendation that Mr. George was making about when he said that he would urge that the committee change the bill to make it clear that it goes directly to the municipality instead of the state. Representative Olberg's description of that is what I think we ought to do in the CS, and it would avoid the problem. But the fundamental question you're asking, Representative Cott, whether it's a dedicated fund or not depends upon whether or not the legislature has to appropriate it. So in other words, you can charge a tariff or a fee or whatever and say it goes into a special account within the general fund, but in order for it to be used for the purpose that people want to spend the money on, it has to be appropriated by the legislature. That's what allows you to set up funds. An example of that is the fisheries enhancement tax that fishermen pay, the 1% or 2% or 3%, whatever the regional aquaculture associations decide their fishermen will pay, goes into a special account in the general fund. That sounds like a dedicated fund, right? Except that every year the legislature has to appropriate it to that regional aquaculture association. And the act of the appropriation is what avoids the constitutional prohibition about dedicated funds. If it went in automatically, it would be a dedicated fund. Is that clear? Or did I probably go good?
So what would happen to that if we chose not to fund it?
If we chose not to fund it?
Mm-hmm.
The funding for the Regional Agriculture Association?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely nothing, in the sense that we would have the ability not to appropriate the money to those Regional Agriculture Associations. But they would be quick to be tied. They would be coming to you and everybody else in the legislature and saying, we paid this tax because we had the understanding not broken the law, but broken our understanding about our paying this tax for this purpose. But we would have the authority to do that. We'd have the authority to spend it on road maintenance if we wanted to, because it's not a dedicated fund. But they'd be pretty upset with us, and the Regional Aquaculture Association would decide not to pay that tax anymore because it's an optional tax.
Okay, so it's an optional tax. That was, okay.
The Aquaculture Associations choose to tax the membership to do that, and it comes back into the general fund, goes back out.
Further questions, or any
thoughts? Say in the case of this building here, each dedicated line would be assessed 50-cent assessment. Is that how this would work? Whereby each individual line is assessed at 50 cents, and there's no cap on it?
I think we'd have to ask the communications people, because it wouldn't be assessed by the number of lines in the building. It'd be assessed by the number of external lines coming into the building, and whether those two are the same.
Well, I would think that if there's an individual line, if you have a house that has two separate lines, unless it's phone, but you can be charged twice.
The fact of the matter is, the state phone system is a mini utility within itself. It has more internal lines than it has external lines, so we'd have to bring somebody from the communications department in here to answer that. But the answer is, it would be unquestionably, it would be thousands of lines, yeah.
Well, let's say
you
have.
Page 3, line 25. A customer that has more than 100 local exchange access lines from the local exchange cell phone company is liable for the surcharge only on 100 and not above.
Oh,
so it does handle major purchasers of lines in that sense. In terms of your case about the individual homes with two lines, I think that'd be twice.
So in my case, with
two
teenagers, two separate lines and myself, all within 5 seconds of one another, we're going to pay three times.
I don't think there's a provision in here to keep you paying it only once. I don't think so, unless your local exchange access line is somehow considered by the phone system as one because you've got the same address. I don't know that. We have to get to the phone folks.
Representative Goldberg?
Two teenagers, each with their own line.
Hey, each have
you should pay twice.
Hey, they're out there with their own job.
So
make them
pay.
Refund to you.
Yeah.
Charge them the buck.
Yeah, they're paying, not you.
You're not paying for their phone, are you?
No.
Oh, good, good.
Well, I am.
Heck,
I
don't
have
my
team
anymore either, so.
If there are any further questions, we'll adjourn the meeting. The meeting stands adjourned at 9:18.
Well, that's what I thought. You see, my son turned 21 and my daughter turned 20. No longer teenagers, and they're still around. So, and then he leaves the roost.
Later, though.
No, I was always told when they're 18, they're on their own.
The biggest disappointment is when they leave home and bring their
come
bring their spouses with them.
I suppose. They have to look forward to it.